Hi, welcome to FRA's Roundtable Insight. This is Richard Benulli. Today we have Pete Lidwin and Ira Harris. Pete started out as a lecturer at the University of Pretoria, subsequently joined the Central Bank of Africa, South Africa, as an economic analyst. He joined Allan Gray Investment Council in 1991 as a portfolio manager, later moved to Investec Asset Management. He's currently chairman of RAC Limited, as well as the director of Mauritian-listed investment company Asturia. He also manages Counterpoint South African Value Fund, an open-ended investment vehicle that invests in South African equities. Ira is a hedge fund manager, global trader in foreign currencies, bonds, commodities, and equities for over 40 years. He's currently served as a CME director recently, between 1997 to 2003, and also most recently. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for having us. This is great. Thank you.
Great. I thought we'd do a focused discussion on a presentation, Pete, that you recently gave on financial repression at an investment conference in South Africa. We're very interested in doing that discussion to get your thoughts on the topic. What are the points you made at that presentation?
Yes, thank you. I think the key point I made at the presentation was to highlight the very high levels of debt to GDP ratios that obtain almost throughout the whole world. Almost every government in the world is spending a lot of money. Governments are borrowing money. Corporates are borrowing money. So debt levels are very high and extended in relation to economic activity. And I think if one thinks through this, it sort of strikes you that with increased debt levels over the past 10 years, economic growth rates have also been declining and interest rates have been declining. And I think that is, you know, it's almost like the debt levels are acting as a drag on economic growth and interest rates everywhere. And the problem of high debt needs to be solved. We can't carry on with these. You know, if something isn't sustainable, if we can't carry on forever, then it's got to stop at some point. So I guess that at some point something has to be done about reducing the debt to GDP ratios in many, many countries. So, you know, and then when you start looking at that, there's a few ways the fiscal and monetary authorities can go about doing that. A couple of ways work on the numerator. In other words, you can either default on the debt, as many countries have done in the past. That you know, brings the debt to GDP ratio down quite quickly. You can also implement austerity measures and save more and thereby bring down debt levels. Both of those, I think, would be fairly unpopular in most democratically elected governments, and even in some less democratic governments. Those would not go down very well because they imply some measure of discomfort for the voting population. And as we know, that's not something that most governments would choose of their own volition. So that leaves you a third method of reducing the debt to GDP ratio, and that is by increasing GDP, in nominal terms at least. So growing your GDP at a rate in excess of which the debt levels are increasing. And of course, the way to do that is through inflation. If you can inflate your GDP in nominal terms, debt as relative to economic activity becomes less onerous. And that's exactly what the world did. Well, the U.S. did post-World War II and many other places in the world as well. So if you look at the 1940s to 50s, that was exactly the sort of policies they implemented at that time. So I guess the gist of what I'm saying is almost when you think through the whole problem of very high debt levels, almost the only way out is through inflation. The only acceptable way out is through inflation. I guess that's lead into what happens next, which I guess is financial repression.
Great. Then your initial thoughts, Ira?
Well, I can hang up and leave now. That's no, that's exactly right. You know, and we've discussed so many times, you know, with Mark Faber, with Felix Zuloff, with Rosenberg. You know, we are caught in this situation. And as I was having this discussion this morning with a few people, and I go, you know what, I am multifaceted in my use of theory, but I am so more reliant on the Austrian school, who places a, and it's one of the things back when I was in university, which really caught my attention, was their concern about debt and debt overhang. And intertemporal misallocation and everything that comes with it. So yeah, you know, I read a lot of economic history. You know, Fernand Braudel is one of my favorite people to read. I have volume two of the Wheels of Commerce sitting, and I'm almost done again for my third time because I had to go back and reread a thing. And we're always the best way to eradicate that. Look, you could restructure it, and that's fine. I'm sorry. Yeah,
that is one way out. That is one way out, but that's a hard road, and I don't think people are willing to travel hard roads these days.
I agree with you. And you can restructure Argentinian debt, Brazilian debt, yeah. You know, the whole Club of Rome or Club of Paris back in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. But when you are the world's reserve currency and you give up acting as a fiduciary, a systemic fiduciary, you're not restructuring that. It's just too big and too vast. This is not, you know, Turkey or any, we can go through a litany.
South Africa, for instance.
Yeah, South Africa. And, yeah. You know, and South Africa was interesting because I had the pleasure in 1999. Yeah, I was on the CME board of directors, and I had a huge role in the currency markets and policy for the exchange, getting ready to launch the South African Rand and as a futures product and be able to trade it. And Trevor Manuel came out with, I had no idea, but I was the one who sat and had lunch with him and talked to him. And I told him, I said, wow, the fact that South Africans, and I use this phrase, I'm sorry to say, he was there with Maria Ramos, who I found later, they had more than casual relationship, but as bright as Trevor Manuel was, Maria Ramos really knocked my socks off. She was phenomenal. But I said to Trevor Manuel, I said, I can't believe you're actually allowing this. I said, here in the States, we would say you have the testicles of a mountain lion in order to do this, because aren't you afraid that the amount of money that's going to make its way out from South Africa, there'd be a flood of money fleeing. And he says, well, if it's going to be, it's going to be. But they were dead right on target. And I thought it took a lot of guts, so much so that when they were discussing after Dominique Strauss-Kahn was no longer going to be the director of the IMF, I had actually written a letter that was published in the FT advising that they should really choose Trevor Manuel. They need to step out of that European conundrum and appoint somebody, because I thought he was a great voice of
He was. And under his leadership, South Africa actually went through a period of 15 years from about 1994-5 to about 2010-2011 of relatively free markets. And the country benefited tremendously from that. So yes, you're right. He was a great financial leader and implemented some really good free market policies. Yeah, so that was good.
I'm sorry.
Yes. No, carry on.
And the fact that the currency was allowed to float, just like the peso, you know, float, Milton Friedman and George Shultz and Leo Melamed, who has a new book out, The Father of Futures, who really helped create the financial futures market, they were right. When you let currencies float and find their mark, their financial level, yeah, you're going to go through extremes, but the market is, and the economy will adjust. So when you saw the depreciation of the rand, you know, okay, and learned to deal with it, and everybody there learned to deal with it. Mexico has really not had a financial crisis since they really let the peso float after what was called the tequila crisis of 94, 95. So you do see that, and markets then let the market tell you what it thinks rather than you always try. You know, the Fed is locked in this bad situation where they're busy telling everybody what to think and what levels to set themselves at. And it causes more disruption than if you had these events where the markets would actually try to find what its underlying level is. And if the central bank has to, God forbid, raise rates in order to defend the currency, wow, you never know what will happen. But you know, South Africa really did well. Okay, and you'll go through some bouts of inflation. And the inflation does relieve some of the debt overhang. But when you bring that to the realm of the world's reserve currency, now we're in a far different, and there's no restructuring of that debt. You can't restructure it. I mean, that would be cataclysmic in so many ways. So what's going to be, I don't know, but I think Ed is absolutely right. We're more financial repression. This is the great work of Carmen Reinhart over the years, dead right on target. And the best way, and even Rogoff says it, Rogoff and Reinhart, this time it's different, that, you know, deal with a 3 or 4 years of 4 to 6 to 8% inflation, and you'll relieve a lot of the debt overhang because your nominal GDP will again, as Fiat brings to the fore, that will create, your nominal GDP will be growing. You'll be able to pay down debt with the illusion of, the money illusion is
nominal dollars. Yes, yep. The illusion of nominal dollars. Exactly. Yeah. So that's quite interesting. You know, if one accepts that inflating GDP is the way out, then I think one needs to accept that at least some measures of financial repression would be implemented. And you know, as per the post World War II period, now most investors, including myself, and I'm sure yourself, Ira, were not around in 1940 and 50, at least not investing money.
No.
So very few investors, or I would say none, no investors have the experience of allocating assets and investing money under a regime of financial repression. And so let's take a step back and say, what does financial repression mean? Financial repression means that you're inflating the economy, you're stimulating the economy, you are, you know, with fiscal stimulus, infrastructure spend, incomes policies, those sort of things. While you're doing that, you cannot afford to let interest rates go up as much as a free market would allow them to go up by, because your debt servicing becomes too onerous if interest rates were to increase too much. So financial repression means keeping a lid on interest rates while you are stimulating the economy fiscally, while you're printing money to stimulate the economy to create high nominal growth rates. And there are a couple of ways to do that. I think one of the key central tenets of financial repression to keep interest rates, long rates low, is to implement some form of control over the asset allocation of institutions. In other words, you have prescribed assets. You tell institutions you have to have 20 or 30 or 50% of your assets invested in government bonds. You force institutions to buy government bonds. That's one way. Another way is price control. Another way is regulated access to credit. You decide who gets access to credit and for what purposes. So it's a much more interventionist type environment, and that has many, many investment implications, which I think is something we as investors have not lived through the past 20, 30 years. It's almost an Alice in Wonderland. It's the opposite of what we lived through. So it has quite a lot of interesting dimensions to it.
You know, that's right. And we're all trying to adjust. And that's why, you know, and I understand out of some of the Austrians, we're looking for, you know, and we've discussed this, Richard, on in these podcasts over the last year, some sense of deflation because of the debt overhang, because the end result of debt overhang is usually restructuring and a collapse in asset values, so you get a deflationary period. I just don't see that happening here, that the central banks will go, they've showed us, they'll go to any extreme possible to ensure that there's massive infusions of liquidity in the system, which do exactly what we, you know, what was just discussed.
Yeah.
You find
it? And they justify it. It's easy to justify these stimuli. I mean, infrastructure spend, who's against clean energy? You can't be against clean energy. And if the government's going to spend a lot of money to create the environment for clean energy, that's a stimulus. You know, you can't be against inequality. And if the government, you know, implements incomes policies to create more equal outcomes for people, you can't be against that. So you'll find that people will support these stimulus measures en masse.
Yeah, I think that's right. That's absolutely right. How do you, you know, and that's where they sit. So now in the U.S., they're discussing the infrastructure. Some people have written me, in fact, a couple of South Africans I know, is the infrastructure project dead? I don't think so. I read a piece yesterday from Dean Baker at the Center for Economic and Policy Research, where there is some people promoting that infrastructure on an annual basis be some percentage of the defense budget. Now, I don't think that that's a bad idea, by the way, because I'm an anti-defense person, because I think there's so much waste in it. Not that you, it's just a matter of waste. The problem with defense spending for me is that it creates so many, so many acts of malfeasance in the whole budget process in the U.S. Because let's face it, there's a lot of Democrats and Republicans whose districts all feed off of the defense spending. You know, I can go back to my days in the 60s as an anti-war activist and civil rights activist, and looking at defense spending, and there was so much waste then. I can only imagine now. So if you really wanted to ramp up your infrastructure and stay current, well, okay, maybe you should dedicate X amount, take some from the defense budget and allocate it to continual infrastructure spending over 8 to 10 years. So I'm going to be watching this very carefully. Nobody will get all that they want here, but it'll be more interesting of what they do get. You know, because politics, of course, is the art of compromise. So how are you going to compromise and what are you going to compromise? So we have a lot of things to be attentive to. And as Pat says, how can you can't be a president. This is, you know, mother, hot dogs, apple pie, and Chevrolet, as we say here. These are great American things.
Do you see that happening, Pete, in South Africa, some of these mechanisms of financial repression, both by governments and the central bank?
Yeah, that's quite an interesting question. And the short answer is no. If you look at our deficit before borrowing, it's about half the U.S. Budget deficit. Our debt levels are a lot less. They have increased rapidly over the past year, given the effects of the pandemic and the lockdowns and that sort of thing. But they are, if you look at the world, South African debt levels and debt ratios are in the lower end of the table. So no, those sort of policies we don't see happening here. Right now, our long bond yield is around 10%. Inflation is around 3%. So we have 6-7% real interest rates here, as opposed to the US, which I think the long bond yield is negative in real terms at this point. And the same in Europe. So, you know, this is more for me a developed market situation than an emerging market situation where you will get financial repression. Mm-hmm. South Africa and other emerging markets had financial repression as late as the 90s. So that's something we lived through here. We have firsthand experience of a financial repression era, but I don't see it coming to emerging markets as much as it is coming to developed markets over the next 10 years.
So like more in Europe, in North America? Sorry, Ira.
It's such a great point. Hey, Richard, can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Yes. Yes. Go ahead. Go ahead.
Okay. So that's such a great point. And you see it play out. And it was interesting because, of course, last week we We saw the Russians, of all people, once those Nord Stream 2 sanctions were lifted by the White House, I mean, the next day, the Russians came with $2 billion in bond offering. And by the way, I really think the Russian bank is one of the better managed central banks in the world under Elvira, the mistress of the dark, as I call her, but she's quite good. and they have one of the things that, and it's interesting when you think about South Africa, with 10% yield on the long bond, they have a genuine real yield, positive real yield.
Yeah, one of the few in the world.
Yeah, the Russians, I think, have it too. Your ECB is a joke because we know that German inflation is probably conservatively running 3%. And we applaud that now the Bund is only negative, 13 basis points. So, wow, gee, a real negative yield of buying German debt of a negative 3%. And this is a critical factor. And I'm glad we're going this because when I wrote Sunday's blog, Richard, I cited that work that came out over the weekend from Liberty Street, which is the research arm of the New York Federal Reserve. And it talks about, will they be able to fund the debt? Because foreigners are really not buying U.S. Treasuries. Treasuries have been going up or treasuries have been holding steady, at least. We had that one move up in yields, but in a break in the bonds, because of the huge pool of savings, personal savings in the U.S., because of course, all the stimulus checks and everything else, and people's savings, because there was nothing to spend money on, especially people in the top percent of the income. There was nothing to spend money on for 13 or 14 months. You couldn't go anywhere. No movies, no plays, no live concerts, whatever you want. There was nothing to spend money on, so it went into savings. So that savings was able to, that combined with the Federal Reserve's asset purchases, were to keep bonds financially repressed. But at the end of the piece put out by the New York Fed, there's, and I'm quoting, this is the paragraph, a further complicating factor, because if these savings get run down and the foreigners, I'm speaking to that, and if the foreigners don't step in to lend money, and if I'm a foreigner outside of Japanese institutions, which for God, why they chase nominal yields is beyond me, but if they don't step in because of negative real yields being maintained by the Federal Reserve, there's going to be a problem. Now, it's not yet, of course, because there's a huge pool of private savings, but the last paragraph in this New York Fed release says this: a further complicating factor in anticipating how this plays out, meaning what happens with the U.S. debt markets, is that the amount of U.S. borrowing has to be equal to the sum of net lending by the rest of the world. Essentially, any increase in the U.S. savings shortfall has to be matched by a bigger savings surplus elsewhere, and the mechanism that makes this identity hold has very unclear implications for exchange rates and global asset prices. I think that's such a critical piece because the people will come to the U.S., but not if negative real yields are sustained. And that's when the dollar will get into trouble. I mean, I know people want to be bullish the dollar, and because all central banks are geared off the Fed, all major central banks, or as Piet says, the developed world central banks, and that's where the problem lies, they're all geared to the Fed because nobody wants their currency to disassociate from it. So how are you going to be able to fund this? And this is when it's going to get into trouble, and it's really the beginning of the conversation that we had started, because the Fed is going to have to step in with yield curve control, which is the old bastion of financial repression. There's going to be but that will not help the dollar. So there are, now when is this going to happen? I can't tell you, but I know that it's part of the overhang to the overall, to the global financial story.
Yeah, the timing of financial repression is difficult, but it seems to me we're inexorably heading that way. I guess if there is, to your point, if there is a shortfall in U.S. saving, it can be funded from foreigners. But if they don't want to, then there's only one other alternative, and that is to impose prescribed assets on U.S. saving institutions and force them to buy up the debt. No, that's the alternative.
Well, and again, the key word is force.
You would have to force them to buy those bonds.
And we see it in Europe. I mean, the ECB, whether under Draghi, was a master of it. And, it's one of the issues that we've discussed, I don't know, Richard, for 4 or 5 years already, how Merkel got so beat up and bested between Draghi and Sarkozy, what the media love to call Merkozy because of the relationship. But the French and Draghi, as the president of the European Central Bank, basically placed the entire debt burden of the EU upon the German credit card and upon the German taxpayer. I mean, they're still battling this. There was last week, Karlsruhe, the German High Court, put an end to it for the moment by saying that the Bundestag had actually dealt with the proportionality issue of ECB bond buying. So that'll quiet it. And actually, the euro has quietly found a rally. I think it had a lot to do with the ruling out of Karlsruhe. But Merkel walked into this trap, and the German populace is on the hook for the guarantee of the entire edifice of the ECB. And they're masters now at sustaining exactly what the Fed is sustaining. So everybody is being financially repressed to deal with their debt overhang.
Exactly. That's a good point.
Do you see the potential, Pete, also for prescription, not only at the institution level, but also at the personal level in terms of government-sponsored or government-registered accounts, like in the U.S., the 401k plan, or the in Canada, the RSP plan, where governments mandate a certain percentage of the assets must be in government bonds?
Yeah, look, I wouldn't know exactly how they will implement it. All I do know is that by their very nature, once regulators get the bit between their teeth, they get quite excited and they come up with okay. very interesting rules and regulations, and it can take all sorts of forms. But of course, you want to get the maximum bang for your buck. So I think you probably start with institutions, the pension funds and those sort of things, and regulate them. And maybe not so much the man in the street, but who knows? I wouldn't like to speculate as to the exact nature of the regulation. All I know is there's a lot more regulation coming, forcing savers to buy bonds, which nobody else would want to touch because of the negative real yields that they would offer.
Yeah. And your thoughts, Ira?
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. We see it. We see it all over the place. Look at what's going on in Europe, and it's going on, well, Japan and Australia has walked into it with the, they have yield curve control from 3 years down. Canada is trying to break away here, but the currency has gotten a little too strong. So I'm sure they're going to get a little, even though I think there's more upside in the Canadian because, number one, a natural resource story always. They're a little too tied to the energy. But the fact that they were willing to taper as a little test. And I know all the conversation that goes on back and forth in the U.S. We see it. We hear it every day. We'll hear it today. We heard it yesterday. They're trying to will they force it? If they had to, they would force it. They would force, if Piet is right, the pension funds to buy. How it'll play out in each place, we don't know. But we've already seen that in Japan.
And Australia for that matter. In South Africa, it happened from 1980 to 1995. We had financial repression, and it was a very interesting period. Volcker killed inflation in the US in the late 70s, early 80s. Inflation still dragged on for quite a while in South Africa until about 1994 when we had the political transition. But during that period, we had financial repression. Pension funds had to invest 50% of their assets in government bonds. That was the rule. under inflationary conditions, the rules of investing or what you need to invest in is very different to what you need to invest in under deflationary conditions, which we experienced for the past 30 years. So again, I make the point that we have almost two generations of investors who have invested under deflationary conditions. And if this thing goes the way I expect it to, I think one will have to invest in very different ways going forward. And that's an interesting discussion to have.
That's such a great point. And it comes back to what we're seeing. And Richard, you and I and Rosenberg discussed this months ago. He disagreed, but all of a sudden he's done a volta voce. You know, one of the inflationary impacts to me in the world is that the Chinese have moved from a deflationary force to a potential inflationary force, because as they let that yuan and they're not fighting it. And you saw the discussion over the last 5 days. My heart beat faster because somebody from the People's Bank of China talked about that a stronger yuan was good to fend off the impact from rising raw materials prices. And then that article all of a sudden got deleted. And then the Chinese were out over the weekend talking about a stable yuan. Well, the Chinese putting forth a stable yuan is as bullish on the currency as you could possibly get. Because that's usually the thought is the other way. But that yuan has been strengthening, even when the global economy was really struggling, and yuan strengthened as commodity prices were rising. So I have maintained, my theory has been over the last 8 months, is that the stronger yuan represented that China was stockpiling all types of raw materials, you know, from copper to iron ore, because it was, if you're buying in those kind of amounts, a stronger currency serves you well. But that makes a stronger yuan means that Chinese exports are not going to be the deflationary force that they were on the world for 25 years, which allowed the central banks to believe that they had everything under control. It was more out of the aspect of the huge impact of a billion Chinese in the global workforce. That's going to, I think, change. And I know we're doing Michael Pettis next week, I believe. Mm-hmm. So we'll get into the heart discussion. And if the China is going to move to a more domestic consumption economy, a stronger yuan fits that purpose very well. And I think that's what South Africa saw, right?
Yeah, that it's interesting that you raise that, because I firmly believe that we are in a bull market in terms of commodities. I haven't yet thought about the Chinese yuan aspect of creating an inflationary impulse in the world, but that's a very interesting point. But there's no doubt that we're in a bull market of commodities. I mean, if you look at the CRB index, it's breaking out to new highs all the time. You know, for me, it looks very constructive in terms of commodities. And when you think about a financial repressionary environment, what you want to invest in is hard assets that maintain their value, like commodities. You want to invest in asset-intensive businesses. I mean, one of my first investing lessons I learned just coming out of university, and this was 19, so this probably dates me, but this was early 80s, when we had negative real interest rates in South Africa, the first thing you did was you borrowed as much money as you could and you bought the fanciest car you could afford with that borrowed money, because the car would depreciate at a slower rate than inflation. And so in 5 years' time, you had paid off your debt and the car was worth a lot more on the secondhand market than you paid for it originally. So that was the sort of environment which is completely opposite to what we've been used to over the past 20 years. You know, hard assets appreciate in value over time because of inflation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, and see, that's how people learn how to deal with things. You know, in the U.S., we're not as good, we're not as intelligent as dealing in the shadows, so to speak. You know, yeah. Are great at it because they had to be. The Chinese were pretty good at it, but now the system is it's autocratic, but not that autocratic. So they've had to learn to deal with it. The South Africans had to learn to deal with it. People who've lived through this stuff, and you find that people are not as stupid as the central banks want to believe.
They never are. They never are. People are smart. In the aggregate, people are very, very smart. And you know, so, and if you look around the world today, which central banks are ahead of the curve? And it's Brazil. They're hiking rates. Russia is hiking rates. South Africa is talking about hiking rates. All those countries have positive real rates. They have less debt relative to GDP than most developed countries. And these are the pariahs of the world, or the historic pariahs of the world, that seem to be economically better off, at least in relative terms, to the rest of the world. So again, it's a big change to what we're used to.
Yeah, yeah. And think about that. That's why, you know, I say to people, I said, you know, with that move and the removal of sanctions, you better watch the ruble here, because the ruble, which is trading 73 to the dollar, could move back to 60 or 62 quickly, because first of all, it will fit. The Russians need to follow a little bit of the Chinese script. And I think under Elvira, I don't pronounce her name well enough to do this, but I have great respect for her. And she's kept rates. She was like one of the first ones to move them higher. The Brazilians are now, because they took them fabulously too low, as far as the silica rate was just, that they went from the highest real yields in the world to trying to combat. I don't think that their inflation situation, although the inflation in Brazil got down to 3-4%, which for them is an amazing factor, but Brazil is, you know, because of their huge agricultural exports and the high, the weak real, I should say, you know, we're still up to 5.95. We're hanging around 5.30 now. Yeah, it's a lot of things to adjust to. But I agree, Piaget's right. The emerging markets, and it's in their interest to keep their currency stronger, of course, because so much of their borrowing has been in dollars. We saw in March of 2020, March and April, that a rising dollar was wreaking havoc on the debt situation in the emerging markets. That's when the Fed, and Richard, I wrote this in the blog 2 weeks before they did it, that they needed to open massive swap lines because they needed to flood the global system with dollars, which they wound up doing. And the huge sell-off that was liquidation that was taking place in the emerging markets ended. That was, to me, very important to righting that ship. So now I think the emerging markets have stabilized here and go, you know, we can deal with a stronger currency, especially with rising commodity prices, because so many of them are involved in the raw materials end of the world. South Africa, who's a better example than South Africa between platinum, palladium?
South Africa at the moment is running record trade account surpluses, the biggest ever in its history, and also current account surpluses because of higher commodity prices, and despite the stronger currency. Our currency has gone from 17 rand to the dollar to 13 rand something to the dollar over the past year, well, since the pandemic struck. So our currency has strengthened considerably, yet we're still running massive trade and current account surpluses. And that is mainly because of higher commodity prices. And I think, I don't know, but I guess that over time the same will happen in Brazil, and the same is happening in Russia with high energy prices.
Yeah, I agree. And the Russians are onto something. I mean, they are politically making some decisions here, and they're getting closer with the Chinese, which suits them for the moment. And now they have the Nord Stream that's going to be completed. So there are, you know, again, everybody wants to be so static in their thinking, but the world is far more dynamic than all these models would indicate. And things are always, you know, and again, I'll quote Louis Gavet from one of the podcasts we did, Richard. My clients don't pay me to forecast. They pay me to adapt. And good trading and good investing requires constant adaptation.
Yeah. I think it was a famous American hockey player who said, don't go to where the puck is, go to where the puck's going to be. Or something along those lines.
That's Richard, the Canadian Gretzky.
Gretzky, Wayne Gretzky. That's right.
And can we delve a little bit deeper onto the investments, given the environment that we've discussed? Like you mentioned also the bull market and commodities. Where do you see the opportunities specifically, like maybe copper or agricultural areas?
So I think the opportunities are across a broad range of commodities. That's, of course, if this whole macro thesis holds. And as you know, to forecast macro is a very hard thing. But I think if one is managing a portfolio, you need to take cognizance of the possibility of this outcome happening. And if that's right, then I think one needs to have a good look at the commodities complex. And I think across the commodity complex, there are opportunities. Over time, I think commodities are driven not by demand so much as by supply. In other words, when there is a lot of supply coming in the market, prices drop. And when there is a contraction in supply, prices increase. Demand is a fairly stable number, and it grows by economic growth, 3 or 4% per annum over time. Some bumps and valleys across time, but it grows at that sort of rate. Where supply is a lot more volatile, because you know when times are good, you know commodity companies, companies who extract commodities, invest a lot into new mines and new production, and then a few years later, because it takes a long time to build a mine, 5-10 years down the line, you get a tremendous surplus in the specific commodity and the prices drop. And then they start contracting their capex and they close down mines and companies go bankrupt and the supply contracts. And that, again, once again, leads to rising prices. So what we've seen over the past 8 to 10 years is that commodity companies have not been investing in new capacity, or there's been very little capex going into new capacity. So if we have an environment where there is stimulus spending and you have high rates of nominal GDP growth, I think there's a broad range of commodities where there will be a tremendous lack of supply, which will lead to further increasing prices. So that's a possible outcome and that I think one needs to be cognizant of, that you can have a dramatic increase in commodity prices from here because of a lack of supply. And I think one should probably focus specifically on those commodities which play into the greening of the economy. In other words, moving to a carbon neutral state. So, you know, copper would be top of the list there. Copper has tremendous supply issues over the next 10 years. And I think it is one of the prime ingredients when you make batteries and when you lay cables for transmission purposes and so on and so forth. So copper is up there. Platinum is up there if you go down the hydrogen route. So, but it's agriculture, very definitely, we've had record crops in both US and Brazil over the past year, and still corn prices are all-time highs. So again, there's something going on there that I think one needs to notice. So, I think a broad range of commodities is something that should be built into portfolios going forward to take cognizance of the possibility of high inflation down the road.
And your thoughts, Ira?
That is just because I was going to say, the only point where Piet and I are going to disagree is when we talk about the choke points in the supply chains causing rising prices. You know, I've been on this. I said, yeah, it's a nice theory, but it doesn't hold, because food prices were like really the first, food and copper over the last 13, 14 months were the first ones to really get the move dynamically. And that was with record crops. So yeah. That scenario, and that's where I came to look at the yuan, the strengthening yuan with rising food prices, as a signal that the Chinese were busy stockpiling, because it made no sense. The global economy was in the absolute throes of a meltdown, and yet food prices started to turn with a strengthening yuan. I said something is wrong here, because again, Brazil, again, two record crops in a row. The U.S., a record crop. Now, the Chinese may be stockpiling because they have as many weather satellites up as anybody, and they may see drought conditions developing, and they wanted to get ahead of it. And especially with a stronger currency, what better than to load up on food? Because one thing the Communist Party can never make the mistake of being short of food. That will not go down. That is probably their greatest fear, is ever being short of food. So So I'm glad you made that point. I'm glad you raised that. Everything else, yeah, there's nothing I disagree with. On the platinum issue, I will raise it because you talked about platinum and hydrogen, right? The fuel cells.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Platinum as a catalyst in hydrogen fuel cells.
Yeah, and I'm a big believer in that. I've been in and out of Ballard Power, another fine Canadian.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But they're not very good at skating where the puck is going to be. They're struggles. But the Japanese and Chinese are still pushing hydrogen in a big way as a besides electric.
I know Toyota's doing a tremendous amount of R&D into that and spending a lot of money on it.
Yeah, I pay attention to it, and they've got buses. So they're working on it, and I agree. And yet the platinum gold spread really fascinating. I traded quite a bit. I'm trading it today, so as we're talking. It's out to, platinum is still $700 negative to gold, which is, you look at the history of it, I think the 200-month moving average, which is just a mean reversion for me, is actually like a positive 350.
Yes. So historically, platinum tends to trade at a premium to gold, interestingly enough.
Yeah, and actually platinum was starting to move, and then, I'm not sure what stopped it, but platinum to me is a much more Asian story anyway, because the Asians seem to appreciate it as a precious metal more than you do in the Western countries. So when Asian wealth rises, I think you will see a platinum move to more center stage. And
I do think, sorry, Ari, to interrupt you. I do think one has to be careful there, though. In the platinum group metals, you have palladium and rhodium, which have gone up tremendously over the past couple of years. They've gone up by, factors. So I think one has to be cautious to just look at platinum. I think you have to look at the whole platinum complex to see what the complex has done relative to the gold. Maybe that's a different way of looking at it, possibly.
Yeah. And I know that palladium went up to $3,000, which is, that's unheard of. Platinum is sat here. So I just watch it. Again, I don't get married to any idea until the market starts to tell me that I'm right. Right now, it was starting to tell me because platinum had a nice move February 1st over that Reddit silver issue,
Yes.
Right? But platinum actually did better because there is a greater shortage of platinum than there is silver by yard. So if you wanted to get on a play, and I think some people started to, but backed off accordingly. But I just wanted to entertain the concept of platinum because I think it's important. But I raise this issue too, because we're going to get into it, I think, in the last minutes, is on the central bank digital currency, right, which is going to rival Bitcoin et al., because we talk about with China. And as I've seen the yuan, and the discussion that takes place about the U.S. the dollar as reserve currency, and is yuan going to try to remove that? Well, if the Chinese were to do that, I believe that their first step is, if they're going to go to a digital currency or even just yuan, they have to back it somewhat with precious metals. Because there's not enough credibility. And historically, because we know that China is a disruptor. There's a paper, I don't know whether you're aware of it, it came out from the Atlantic Group about 7 weeks ago now, 8 weeks ago, called The Longer Telegram. It's written anonymously, and it's meant to be a play on George Kennan's The Long Telegram, talking about the policy of containment in Russia in 1946. This is the longer telegram talking about how they have to deal with China. And it just came out. And there were several references in there. Do not let the dollar depreciate. You cannot lose the reserve status of the dollar. So it's in there. And it talks about the UN. But it also talks about China through viewing China as a status quo power versus a revisionist power. Now, under Deng Xiaoping and Hu Jintao, I think that was absolutely the case, that China was a status quo power. They abided by Deng Xiaoping's phrase of hide and bide, you know, hide your growing strength and bide your time. But Xi seems to think that period is over. And so if China moves from a status quo power to a revisionist power, look for them, in my mind, to back the yuan, whether it's a digital yuan or what, with some precious metal, because that would totally disrupt the whole mindset of Western central banking, right? We, again, you know, as Keynes called gold a barber's relic, but things, in order for China to establish itself. Now, this will be the end, because I know we're coming to the end. But yesterday, Lael Brainard of the Federal Reserve Board gave a speech, private money and central bank money as payments go digital. It was talking about central bank digital coin. And she refers to the development in the U.S. of a possibility digital coin, central bank digital coin, and calls it a stable coin. And here's an interesting thing, because she makes this case at the beginning of her speech. And I think that everybody, well, I don't expect much from the media that they would report on this, but she said a stable coin, the digital coin in the US, is a type of digital asset whose value is, and I think this is so critical, is tied in some way to traditional stores of value, such as government issued or fiat currencies or gold.
That's amazing. That is amazing.
That is phenomenal coming from her, right?
Wow.
Yeah. So at the end of the day, any currency is only worth the amount of trust people have in that currency.
Exactly.
So if the Chinese are going to come with a digital currency backed by an asset that people have trusted through the centuries, then I think they, and would probably speak to their getting more on the front foot and probably becoming more aggressive in global markets. It's quite conceivable that they could go down that route. And such a digital currency backed by hard assets it's possible that it wins the trust of a lot of people and usurps the US dollar's power. I mean, that's a conceivable outcome. I would very much like to read an article that you referred to. I haven't read that. Sounds very interesting.
Go to the Federal Reserve. Go to federalreserve.gov, and you'll see Lael Brainard's speech yesterday. It's yesterday. And she says a lot in here, but she says, unlike central bank fiat currencies, stable coins, that's what she calls the digital coin, do not have legal tender status.
Yeah, that's quite interesting. I'd like to see developments in that.
Yeah, I'm telling you, go and read, and she's a critical voice only because she was the voice for promoting yield curve control. And then ever since last August of 2020, the Fed has cut off all discussion of yield curve control.
I've noticed that.
Right? And she was the one. And I figured Powell would resign and she would head the Fed, and her and Yellen could get this done. And that would be the ultimate bout of financial repression.
Yeah.
That is a very interesting aspect. Something food for thought there.
Yeah. You know what? Richard, you'll send him my email, because after reads it, I want to know in full, because I think you'll be amazed at what she says.
Well, great. It's been an insightful, interesting discussion. How can our listeners learn more about your work, Pete?
I'm on Twitter. At Pete Fillion is my handle on Twitter. So I post a lot of stuff on the markets there. And also the business I manage money for, Counterpoint, counterpoint.co.za is the website address.
Great. And Ira?
Great. And Richard, you'll send me his...
Yep.
Or send him mine. And then he could say, because I want his, I want to know what he thinks after he reads it.
Yeah. I'd like to hook up with you there.
Yeah, it'd be great. It's been a great discussion. And you have seen things where you live. So are you living in South Africa now?
I am, yes. I live in Cape Town. That's right, yeah.
Oh, yeah. I've never been there, but I understand how beautiful it is.
Yeah.
No, it is a beautiful city. It is a beautiful city.
Yeah, that's, I understand it. And thank you for your greatest export, Trevor Noah. He's actually quite
a... Yeah, he's a great guy. We were actually in New York, 2 years ago now, and we actually met him there one night. We went to the show and met him after the show, so that was great.
I read his autobiography, and it was had me laughing, but it made me a big fan of his mother and South African women in general. Because that country runs on the back of the women. I'm sorry.
It does. And his humor is typically South African as well. So it's great.
Yeah.
And I find it amazing that it actually translates into the US and that he is so popular there. So that's funny.
Yeah. You know what? Because he there's a genuineness to him. And he's able to see, because he made a comment last year. His recent comments on something that irritate me, but that's okay. But he made a comment saying, look it, I don't watch television news. That's what he said. And this is my business. He said, I only read papers because I can't watch this crap. Because that's my sentiments exactly. I go, people say, don't you watch this and that? And I said, why would I watch that? I don't care whether it's Fox, CNN, MSN. I know what they're going to say. There's nothing new. They're not going to teach me anything.
Most of it is noise. Most of it is noise in any case.
Pure noise. And as he says, it's all narrative. I'll figure it out myself. You don't have to speak it for me.
Great then.
But it was great talking to you, Ara. Richard, great talking to you guys.
This was an absolute pleasure. Thanks, Richard.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Take care. Bye-bye.
Okay. Goodbye now.
Yeah.
All the best. Okay, take care. Yeah.